Arizona's news station. KTAR News on 92.3 FM. Bruce St. James and Pamela Hughes.
So there's some numbers and statistics out there that we should share. According to the U.S. Census, 32% of American adults have a bachelor's degree. By the way, that is the largest percentage ever in our nation's history.
A third.
Right now, 19 million Americans are enrolled in an undergraduate college program. And of course, you know, every year, millions more join the ranks. So looking at colleges and how people choose colleges is a whole industry into itself, right, Pamela? There's publications, there's visits, all this stuff, right? But what if I told you, what if I told you that the fastest growing college and university in the United States is smack dab in the middle of the valley? You would say,
wow, what school is this? ASU?
I was going to say, you, as being a Sun Devil, you'd go, hello, ASU.
Yeah.
Doy.
You look at the number of growth. And
you would be wrong.
Yeah, I would.
You would be wrong. That is because, literally, the top 100 colleges and universities, based on growth, on
5 years.
Five-year growth. Mm-hmm. Number one on the list, Grand Canyon University.
GCU, over the last 5 years, has seen an increase in applications of about 375%.
Wow. Growing and growing fast. And you can see that if any of you have driven past the campus. If you drove past it 5 years ago, go look, there's a couple little buildings there. You drive past it and go, what the heck is going on here?
Right. It has just absolutely exploded.
Yes.
And it is now the fastest, well, I guess you could say, growing university, where you have the applications that are rising. And that's a pretty phenomenal feat, Bruce, when you consider that there are thousands upon thousands of four-year institutions. If you're looking at public and private and small and large and urban and rural and nonprofit and for-profit, there are so many different schools to choose from.
Yeah.
So what is Grand Canyon doing that is lending itself to seeing a 375% increase in 5 years?
And the numbers themselves. So we talk about the percentage. Current undergraduate enrollment is 49,500 students. 49,500. So you say, well, I mean, you know, is that big or not, you know, compared to what? I'll give you some names of other schools that you've heard of. University of Kansas, right? You heard of University of Kansas? Has 19,000 total undergrads, all right? You've heard of that? How about the University of Utah, right? The Utes, how about 24,000? Boston University, BU, 18,000. Not only is it growing, but it's becoming one of the larger universities in the country.
And when you also consider that when you have more and more applications,
mm-hmm.
it allows the school to be more and more selective in their admissions process.
Okay.
They could take the best of the best that they feel is going to represent their community well. Now, I
can
think it's interesting.
Picky.
Yeah.
Can be picky.
I think it's interesting that, okay, so they took a look at 5 years. What schools grew the most as far as the number of applications that they were receiving over a five-year period.
Okay.
And Grand Canyon University led the list of 100 colleges.
By far led the list.
Now, Grand Canyon, though, has kind of gone through, I don't want to necessarily say like an identity crisis, but it has really changed a lot over the years since,
like,
I've been in Arizona.
Can I make the argument? Fundamentally changed. Because for years, Grand Canyon was a, please correct me if I got the timeline wrong, was a private Christian university.
At one point, yeah.
Right? And its enrollment was a tenth of what it is today. Much smaller school. And then, I'm not trying to be disparaging, the business of education kind of took over.
Well, here's kind of the timeline, because I wanted to dive into this, because in my time here in the Valley, it has gone from one identity to another identity to another identity. And so in 2004, GCU found itself facing closure. It almost closed. $20 million in debt, less than 1,000 students.
Right.
And at that time, they switched to become a for-profit school. Fast forward to 2008.
Okay.
That's when they became a private religious college.
Okay. They switched from that.
And this is, then transitioned to being like a publicly traded corporation.
Right.
Now, at that time, also remember about 2008 is when the reputation for for-profit schools really started to take a turn downwards, right? And in 2014, company announced that they wanted to turn the university back to a nonprofit, but that proposal was refused. So then fast forward to January of this year.
This year.
Okay,
yes.
We're now into 2018.
Right.
The for-profit university resurfaced its bid to become a nonprofit, this time with more success. It's been approved.
Right.
So now it's back to being a nonprofit.
What does all this mean for students? You know, one of the things I wanted to look at was, and again, these numbers are what they are. What are the graduation rates? What is fundamentally different? Because it appears to me that GCU... Which, by the way, Dan texted me. He goes, by the way, it stands for Grand Construction University.
Ouch. Da-dum-tsh. Yeah, all right. I'm here all day. Try the view. Because they're building a lot.
Constantly.
I mean, the campus
they
is
have
just
to.
Grown.
You look at this, and they are getting, that last calendar year, they received 34,000 applications to attend school. Their acceptance rate is 57%. Okay?
Okay.
So they're letting a lot of kids are coming into school.
And they've got about a 50,000 student enrollment.
Literally right at that right now, 49.
Okay, let's put the, you know, pen to paper. What are we talking about when it comes to graduation rates? People are going to GCU to get that diploma to further their education along with, you know, some 19 million other Americans that are enrolled in an undergraduate program.
According to the college scorecard, using data from 2015 to 2016, last full time, right? The graduation rate at Grand Canyon University is 36%.
That doesn't seem good to me.
It seems a little on the low side. I can certainly acknowledge that.
All right. So I wanted to check to see how my alma mater, ASU, factored in to graduation rates.
Using the same metric.
Apples to apples.
Within a six-year time span, the graduation rate at ASU is 63%.
And U of A, where you attended.
Bear down.
The graduation rate is 60.
60. So is that, now I'm not blaming Grand Canyon. Is that because the people going to Grand Canyon would have had trouble getting into U of A or ASU? It appears that they are less... It appears that ASU and U of A are more selective, at least when it comes to their acceptance rates. They accept a smaller percentage of those that apply. So is Grand Canyon opening its doors to people who wouldn't get into other colleges, which means they may struggle to finish within 6 years?
I don't know. I'm
not trying to make excuses. I'm trying to understand.
Maybe the rub lies within that acceptance rate, because...
Are you letting people in who can't, who literally can't compete at a college?
If they're number one in the top 100 colleges and universities where student applications are on the rise in the United States, you figure having a 370% increase in 5 years would give you the freedom and the flexibility to be a little choosier.
You could be a little choosier.
A little choosier.
But if, and over the course of these years, you are concerned about a bottom line.
And building that campus.
And Grand Construction University. Do you need to let people in with the hope that they graduate? But hey, we need warm bodies paying tuition around.
Hey,
here.
You know what? GCU is growing. It is becoming a viable option for a lot of students
here.
In the Valley. Whereas in the past, it may not have been. Is it exactly where you see ASU and U of A? No. I don't think that that's really where they want to be. And I think that the student that goes to GCU may not be the same kind of student that goes to ASU or U of A.
I'm still blown away. And maybe I'm the only one.
What's up?
When you again, let's go with 50. Let's round up. There's 50,000 undergraduate students at GCU.
Yeah, that's big.
But again, do people think that's big?
I do.
UCSD, University of California, San Diego. Try 28,000. Washington State University, 25,000. The University of Alabama, 33,000. GCU is bigger than all of these schools.
I can see your eyes. Your eyes are like, wide. You just didn't know that.
I don't know. Maybe it's because of like football or athletic. I think University of Alabama. How many students are there? I don't know. 400,000. I don't know. They must have a million around there. I don't know. They've got a football stadium that fits the entire state of Alabama and half of Georgia.
But isn't that funny how we all use different metrics for how we determine our viewpoint?
What is
on
a big
university?
School?
Yeah.
But a big school by definition of undergraduate enrollment, GCU, is a huge school. Huge school when compared to other schools that you think are big. They get almost twice as many as the University of Alabama. Seriously. Wow, I think it's amazing in and of itself. So listen, I wish the best. I think it's awesome that they have this opportunity and that they continue to grow like that. And I know lots of people that go to GCU and love it. All right, the cost-benefit analysis. Is it more cost-effective to rent in Phoenix or buy?
Bruce St. James and Pamela Hughes.
To rent or to buy?
That is the question.
And you know what? The answer can change. Market conditions, etc., will change. And we are looking, first off, in our own backyard, looking in the valley, renting versus buying, and also nationwide. What are the trends saying out there? Because we know that there is an ebb and a flow to housing affordability, rent affordability, just like all other economic indicators. There's peaks and there's valleys.
Yeah, and defined affordability, because affordability in Phoenix is very different than affordability in San Francisco, right? So when you take a look on a national level as to what we think as Americans is the best option, is it better to rent, meaning cheaper, or is it cheaper to buy?
Okay.
And right now, we got over 3/4 of Americans now saying renting. Renting is more affordable than owning a home.
That's nationwide.
Nationwide.
Now, I have a lot of friends and visit California a lot, and I don't understand how anybody can buy a home in California. Like anything.
That's why a lot of them are moving here.
Like a one-bedroom, 400 square feet. It's a bit of a fixer-upper, but it's $1.3
million.
Jeez. What? What? Like, if you lost your ever-loving minds, huh? I'd buy an RV first so I could drive the darn thing around, parking in Walmart parking lots before I bought that damn house.
Oh, my goodness.
People are lunatics.
Okay, so that's Cali. Here in the Valley, it still is cheaper to buy than to rent.
Yeah.
That is starting to change, though, and it may not stay like this for long. We are still one of those markets that has the median home price at about $225,000.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. When you take a look at the 3-bedroom fair market rent is about $1,500 a month.
Okay.
So, you know, if you buy a home, you're going to see a jump in appreciation over the last year or so. And it's still a good deal to own in the Valley versus renting. But as you see home prices, like
continue to go up. The appreciation is on the rise.
What else is on the rise? Mortgage rates are on the rise
and
as well.
And so at some point that slows it down, right? I mean, this is just simple math, I'm assuming, of which I'm horrific at. I didn't graduate the University of Arizona. I merely attended.
Yeah. Okay.
That there is a tipping point for a lot of people, right? In the Valley, still making sense, buying better than renting. But I can acknowledge that there's probably a time when there isn't. You don't have to go back that far to when the bottom fell out of the market around here. And those of us that were around know exactly what that whole thing felt like and the impact that it had and the fundamental changes it had in the Valley's economy. But I know people, and I want to raise my hand right now and say, I'm not one of them because I'm not nearly smart enough to do this. But I met people who said, oh, yeah, I sold my house 6 months before. You know, the bottom fell out. And I took that money, I put it in the bank, I rented for 2 years. Then I went back and basically bought the same house for about half of what I sold it for. And I'm like, how do you do that? Mm-hmm. They go, well, we're smart. Well, that's obviously why.
Well, you talked about the changing economy and how it even changed the landscape of the valley. Think about how many people were going out to Maricopa.
I still have friends. Matt, why do you live in Maricopa? Seriously.
And we're buying homes there because that's all that they could afford because
they had to
everything else closer.
45 minutes outside of town.
Had gone through the roof.
To get a four-bedroom house or have a pool or have a yard because they couldn't afford to live in the valley.
And I had a friend who had done the same thing and then ultimately had to walk away from the property.
Yeah.
People out in Santan doing the same thing.
Oh my goodness. That's not even in Maricopa County.
Things have changed. We're still at a point where buying is a better option than renting in the valley.
Yeah.
We're one of those fewer markets, and it could be changing here soon, but it's a little different than the rest of the country, and I like that.
To say the least. So we spent the yesterday, Pamela, while you weren't here, talking a little bit about the debate, the Senate debate between Congresswomen McSally and Sinema. Is that the proper verbiage in there? It's close. But what are some of the signs as to why Arizona is having a competitive Senate race, where before the Senate races weren't competitive?
Right,
it was the Republican primary was basically who was going to win.
Yeah.
Not so anymore.
Why?
What's changing? We'll tell you why, including some things you probably hadn't thought about. Coming up next.
Arizona's news station, KTAR News on 92.3 FM. Get some perspective. Bruce St. James and Pamela Hughes.
There's something a little different about the Senate race in Arizona this cycle. And the fundamentally different thing is, for the first time in a while, we have a competitive Senate race. The race between Congresswoman Sinema and Congresswoman McSally is razor thin. We have polling data that shows both of them in the lead with different polls. The average of the polls, the last one I saw, had Sinema in the lead, a poll average by 1.8%. The plus minus on the polls was 3%. So
yeah.
Within the margin of error.
Dead heat.
Right? But it is news in and of itself that this is a competitive seat where Jeff Flake didn't sweat that out that much. Senator McCain never sweated out an election. And the only real competition they ever had was in the primaries. The closest race was in the primaries. And once it got to general election, it was a foregone conclusion that the R was going to win the Senate seat. The R was going to win governor. The R. We've been a state dominated by the R's, but that is changing, and changing for some, dare I say, obvious reasons, but other maybe not so obvious reasons.
Yeah, you know, we've heard about Arizona, a predominantly red state. And is it turning more purple? We're not going blue, all
no.
right? But are we having more of a Democratic influence within our state? And if you talk to people that study this stuff, which you and I do a lot, you'll find out that part of that, and the reason you hear more about it, is our state's demographics are changing, primarily when it comes to the growing number of Latino residents, right?
So we've heard the changing demographics in Arizona, that we have a larger percentage of Latinos. We also have more young people because politics in Arizona were dominated by old white people for the longest time, and old white people vote predominantly Republican.
Right now, the growing number of Latino residents make up about 30% of our state's population. Okay. And if you're looking at, you know, R versus D, I'm not trying to say that, you know, Latinos are monolithic and they always vote Democratic. But if you're looking at where historically that demographic has voted, it has been for D's. Okay, so that's starting to turn the pool a little bit purple. All right, but how do we really get there?
Okay.
This is something I hadn't spent much time thinking about, Bruce.
All right, this is the oh wow factor.
Yeah, you know, we just talked about, is it better to rent or buy in Arizona,
right,
in Phoenix? And it's still better to buy.
Still economical, still makes sense to buy a home. Homes are relatively affordable compared to the rest of the country.
And especially compared to
California. Not even close. Not even close.
So what we're seeing is more and more people moving to Arizona from liberal states
like
California.
For economic reasons.
Last year, here in Arizona, we gained nearly 80,000 new residents in just 1 year. So that puts us in like the top five fastest growing states in the country. Many of these people that are coming to Arizona, first off, welcome.
Yeah.
Okay. Many of them are coming from states like California, looking for that low overall cost of living. And if you're looking at states, like if you look at Texas, it's red. If you look at California, it's blue. If you're getting more people from California than, say, Texas, that's going to be impacting the water to make it a little bit more purple.
What I don't understand about this, because I've heard the opposite arguments as well.
What's that?
The opposite argument has been that places like California or Texas and some of these other, the Midwest, are becoming more insulated, where there is fewer diversity of thought, that they are circling the wagons. And if you're not part of that tribe, you leave because you have no political clout whatsoever. So think about this. In California, if you are a staunch conservative, right wing as they get, you aren't going to win many elections. There's just way too many D's and left wingers in California. So it strikes me as odd to think about, because you would think if they wanted political power, they'd go to a place where their vote matters, because we've heard that before. Like, if you're in New York State or California and you want to vote for Trump, you lost by a lot. Conversely, if you're in West Virginia or Oklahoma and you wanted to vote for Hillary Clinton, didn't matter. It was never going to win.
I don't think people run it through the filter of where does my vote have the most political power. I think people look at it through the filter of where does my dollar get more bang for the buck.
Don't they want to be surrounded by other people like them? We've heard about entire communities where you live and you're surrounded by people who think like you do.
Yeah, but I honestly don't think that when it comes from folks from California coming to Arizona, they're not leaving a blue state because they're red and coming to Arizona. I think that they're leaving a blue state and coming to Arizona because their dollar doesn't go as far. I don't think people look at life through the political lens that often. Mm-hmm. Does it happen? Sure, it happens. Just go on your Facebook feed. You'll see how that happens.
Sure.
But when it comes to making a major life decision, like moving,
your wallet is going to
your wallet,
drive that.
Your job, that industry,
well, think about this.
Is going to drive that decision.
We know organizations like GPEC and others have been courting California businesses to move here. And when a California business maybe relocates, brings its corporate headquarters or manufacturing here, a lot of times it brings employees along with it. Now, I'm not saying that if 100 Californians move here, 100 of them are going to vote for the D's over the R's. But percentage-wise, it is certainly leaning more that direction. And as more and more of them come, it dilutes the voting pool here in Arizona, to where Arizona is rapidly on its way to becoming one of those purple states, which can be good and bad.
When you see about like Mitt Romney, Mitt Romney won Arizona by 10 percentage points over Obama.
Yeah.
Trump won the state 3.5 percentage points over Clinton. Republicans both won, but the margin for which
very
it's happening
much tighter.
Is most definitely tighter.
Tighter.
Hey, you know what? The Charles Schwab Cup Championship comes to the Phoenix Country Club November 8th through the 11th. We're giving you a chance to win tickets. Pretty cool. Just visit the rewards page at KTAR.com for your chance to win tickets to the day of your choice inside the Cold Beer and Cheeseburgers Lounge.
Wow.
Yeah.
All right, there you have it. So even if you haven't done one of those home DNA tests to figure out your 1/1000th Native American, other people in your family might be doing those DNA tests and putting your privacy at risk. What safeguards are in place? Even if you've never taken a DNA test, can your DNA information be used by others? We'll tell you that story. It's coming up next on Arizona's News Station.
KTAR News on 92.3 FM. Get some perspective. Bruce St. James and Pamela Hughes.
There have been a couple stories recently about kind of the good, the bad, the ugly of DNA testing, finding out your genealogy. We had the one guy that was suing because his genealogy said he was one whatever-th African-American and he wanted to apply for a minority loan. And what defines a minority? You had Senator Elizabeth Warren now coming out saying she's 1/1000th or something Native American going back 8 generations. So therefore, she is part Indian in some way, shape, or form, Native American. What does that mean? But a lot of people have been doing these, and they've made it really easy. Some of these tests, 23andMe, that's the one that stands out to me. I don't know. Maybe they just did the
Ancestry.
Best job.
Ancestry.com.
Ancestry.com. Advertising them. But some people say, you know what? Not interested. Don't want to do it because, I told you I'm half German and half Texan, and I'm fine with that. I don't need to find out what 1,000th I am. I'm comfortable with that as a designation. But there is some downside to, dare I say, family members taking these DNA tests and you getting caught up in the mix.
Yeah, I this is interesting to me. You and I both have never taken one of these DNA tests. A lot of people have. They're about $100. You spit into a tube and drop it into the mail, and then they send you back your information.
I'm just not that curious for whatever reason.
Well, you know, but for me, if you wish to maintain your genetic privacy, that's becoming more and more difficult. Your DNA may not be unique enough. Think about it this way. There's a new study out, and it says more than half of us, more than half of Americans, could be identified by name if all you had to start with was a sample of their DNA and a few basic facts. Now, the researchers are saying this could force us to rethink the meaning of privacy in this DNA age.
What defines privacy? Yeah, especially if your second cousin takes a DNA test and you somehow, law enforcement could find you.
More than 1 million Americans have already published their genetic information.
Okay.
Researchers are saying once 3 million Americans upload their genomes to like this public, you know, genealogy.
And this
website.
Is so you can like find family members, long
expand
lost,
your family tree,
etc. Maybe you were adopted, right? Okay.
Well, I mean, when you do that, when you load them up to these genealogy, you know, databases, at that point in time, they've got these powerful computers. They crunch through it. They're looking for stretches of matching DNA sequences to build out your family tree.
Oh my!
Right now, 1 million people have already published their genetic information. Once we reach 3 million, nearly everyone in the U.S. would be identifiable by their DNA alone and just a few additional
even if
clues.
You never took one of these tests, they would have a large enough database to find out. So what is or what can be done to protect, what is it, your genetic privacy?
Well, what some of the researchers are suggesting...
How do I hide that, Pamela?
...is this direct-to-consumer DNA testing companies. Again, the 23andMe, the Ancestry.com. What they want them to do is put, like, a special code on the file that they send you, okay? So when you decide to upload it to one of these sites, you then have to agree to allow people to upload the DNA sequence only if they have this valid code, and that you cannot conduct searches related to somebody other than your own DNA. The reason why is law enforcement is using this. And so there is still some good that comes from it to a certain degree, and you can make that argument. Mm-hmm. For instance, I think the most famous person to be identified this way, Golden State Killer, right?
Serial killer, yes.
They were able to use publicly accessible DNA database in order to locate him, right? It was only the second time in crime-solving history where this was successfully implemented.
Well, and if
Hold on. That happened April 25th.
Right.
It was only the second time, April 25th. Since then, 13 additional suspected criminals have been identified the same way. It opened up the floodgates.
They didn't know what they didn't know. And there is also is a question because, put it this way, this is another example of where technology or science has maybe outpaced the law. Because it's unclear if they even need to get warrants to do this.
Well, okay, but to a certain degree, this sounds like a good thing. You caught a serial killer through this, right? Who's going to not like that? The problem is this very same strategy can be misused. You got foreign governments using this technique to track down American citizens or protesters or activists pursued this way.
I don't like the sound of this.
Right. So,
although
while it sounds like a fun Christmas gift, hey, find out. You know, what are you?
No.
I'm a mutt.
I'm 1,024th Native American.
Careful what you wish for.
Yeah, I know.
Or pay for in this case.
Listen, ignorance is bliss ought to be written on the t-shirt, because that is kind of how I lived my life for quite some time. Former Sheriff Joe Arpaio back in the news, claiming his reputation has been damaged. Damaged, I tell you! By people writing mean things about him. And he's suing. What for? A lot! We'll tell you about it coming up next.